bol. Traffic became languid, scant, even quiet. Shops emptied. Restaurants turned off their lights, closed their doors. Mariam saw no smokers on the streets, no cups of tea steaming from window ledges. And at iftar, when the sun dipped in the west and the cannon fired from the Sher Darwaza mountain, the city broke its fast, and so did Mariam. With bread and a date, tasting for the first time in her 15 years the sweetness of sharing in a communal experience. Except for a handful of days, Rashid didn't observe the fast. The few times he did, he came home in a sour mood. Hunger made him curt, irritable, impatient. One night, Mariam was a few minutes late with dinner, and he started eating bread with radishes. Even after Mariam put the rice and the lamb and okra korma in front of him, he wouldn't touch it. He said nothing and went on chewing the bread, his temples working, the vein on his forehead full and angry. He went on chewing and staring ahead, and when Mariam spoke to him, he looked at her without seeing her face and put another piece of bread into his mouth. Mariam was relieved when Ramadan ended. Back at the Kolba, on the first of 3 days of Eid al-Fitr celebration that followed Ramadan, Jalil would visit Mariam and Nana. Dressed in suit and tie, he would come bearing Eid presents. One year, he gave Nana a wristwatch and Mariam a wool scarf for winter. The three of them would sit for tea, and then Jalil would excuse himself. "Off to celebrate Eid with his real family," Nana would say as he crossed the stream and waved. Mola Faizullah would come too. He would bring Mariam chocolate candy wrapped in foil, a basket full of dyed boiled eggs, cookies. After he was gone, Mariam would climb one of the willows with her treats. Perched on a high branch, she would eat Mola Faizullah's chocolates and drop the foil wrappers until they lay scattered about the trunk of the tree like silver blossoms. When the chocolate was gone, she would start in on the cookies, and with a pencil, she would draw faces on the eggs that he had brought her. But there was little pleasure in this for her now. Mariam dreaded Eid, this time of hospitality and ceremony, when families dressed in their best and visited each other. She would imagine the air in Herat crackling with merriness, and high-spirited, bright-eyed people showering each other with endearments and goodwill. A forlornness would descend on her like a shroud then, and would lift only when Eid had passed. This year, for the first time, Mariam saw with her eyes the Eid of her childhood imaginings. Rashid and she took to the streets. Mariam had never walked amid such liveliness. Undaunted by the chilly weather, families had flooded the city on their frenetic rounds to visit relatives. On their own street, Mariam saw Fariba and her son Noor, who was dressed in a suit. Fariba, wearing a white scarf, walked beside a small-boned, shy-looking man with eyeglasses. Her older son was there too. Mariam somehow remembered Fariba saying his name, Ahmad, at the tandoor that first time. He had deep-set, brooding eyes, and his face was more thoughtful, more solemn than his younger brother's. A face as suggestive of early maturity as his brother's was of lingering boyishness. Around Ahmad's neck was a glittering Allah pendant. Fariba must have recognized her, walking in burqa beside Rashid. She waved and called out, "Eid Mubarak!" From inside the burqa, Mariam gave her a ghost of a nod. "So you know that woman, the teacher's wife?" Rashid said. Mariam said she didn't. "Best you stay away. She's a nosy gossiper, that one. And the husband fancies himself some kind of educated intellectual. But he's a mouse. Look at him. Doesn't he look like a mouse?" They went to Shahr-e-Now, where kids romped about in new shirts and beaded, brightly colored vests and compared Eid gifts. Women brandished platters of sweets. Mariam saw festive lanterns hanging from shop windows, heard music blaring from loudspeakers. Strangers called out, "Eid Mubarak!" to her as they passed. That night they went to Chaman, and, standing behind Rashid, Mariam watched fireworks light up the sky in flashes of green, pink, and yellow. She missed sitting with Mullah Faizullah, outside the kolba, watching the fireworks explode over Herat in the distance. The sudden bursts of color reflected in her tutor's soft, cataract-riddled eyes. But mostly, she missed Nana. Mariam wished her mother were alive to see this, to see her, amid all of it. To see at last that contentment and beauty were not unattainable things, even for the likes of them. They had Eid visitors at the house. They were all men, friends of Rashid's. When a knock came, Mariam knew to go upstairs to her room and close the door. She stayed there as the men sipped tea downstairs with Rashid, smoked, chatted. Rashid had told Mariam that she was not to come down until the visitors had left. Mariam didn't mind. In truth, she was even flattered. Rashid saw sanctity in what they had together. Her honor, her namus, was something worth guarding to him. She felt prized by his protectiveness, treasured and significant. On the third and last day of Eid, Rashid went to visit some friends. Mariam, who'd had a queasy stomach all night, boiled some water and made herself a cup of green tea sprinkled with crushed cardamom. In the living room, she took in the aftermath of the previous night's Eid visits. The overturned cups, the half-chewed pumpkin seeds stashed between mattresses, the plates crusted with the outline of last night's meal. Mariam set about cleaning up the mess, marveling at how energetically lazy men could be. She didn't mean to go into Rashid's room, but the cleaning took her from the living room to the stairs, and then to the hallway upstairs, and to his door, and, the next thing she knew, she was in his room for the first time, sitting on his bed, feeling like a trespasser. She took in the heavy green drapes, the pairs of polished shoes lined up neatly along the wall, the closet door where the gray paint had chipped and showed the wood beneath. She spotted a pack of cigarettes atop the dresser beside his bed. She put one between her lips and stood before the small oval mirror on the wall. She puffed air into the mirror and made ash-tapping motions. She put it back. She could never manage the seamless grace with which Kabuli women smoked. On her, it looked coarse, ridiculous. Guiltily, she slid open the top drawer of his dresser. She saw the gun first. It was black, with a wooden grip and a short muzzle. Mariam made sure to memorize which way it was facing before she picked it up. She turned it over in her hands. It was much heavier than it looked. The grip felt smooth in her hand, and the muzzle was cold. It was disquieting to her that Rashid owned something whose sole purpose was to kill another person. But surely he kept it for their safety, her safety. Beneath the gun were several magazines with curling corners. Mariam opened one. Something inside her dropped. Her mouth gaped of its own will. On every page were women, beautiful women, who wore no shirts, no trousers, no socks or underpants. They wore nothing at all. They lay in beds, amid tumbled sheets, and gazed back at Mariam with half-lidded eyes. In most of the pictures, their legs were apart, and Mariam had a full view of the dark place between. In some, the women were prostrated as if, God forbid this thought, in sojda, for prayer. They looked back over their shoulders with a look of bored contempt. Mariam quickly put the magazine back where she'd found it. She felt drugged. Who were these women? How could they allow themselves to be photographed this way? Her stomach revolted with distaste. Was this what he did then, those nights that he did not visit her room? Had she been a disappointment to him in this particular regard? And what about all this talk of honor and propriety, his disapproval of the female customers who, after all, were only showing him their feet to get fitted for shoes? A woman's face, he'd said, is her husband's business only. Surely the women on these pages had husbands. Some of them must. At the least, they had brothers. If so, why did Rashid insist that she cover, when he thought nothing of looking at the private areas of other men's wives and sisters? Mariam sat on his bed, embarrassed and confused. She cupped her face with her hands and closed her eyes. She breathed and breathed until she felt calmer. Slowly an explanation presented itself. He was a man, after all. living alone for years before she'd moved in. His needs different from hers. For her, all these months later, their coupling was still an exercise in tolerating pain. His appetite, on the other hand, was fierce, sometimes bordering on the violent. The way he pinned her down, his hard squeezes at her breasts, how furiously his hips worked. He was a man, all those years without a woman. Could she fault him for being the way God had created him? Mariam knew that she could never talk to him about this. It was unmentionable. But was it unforgivable? She only had to think of the other man in her life, Jalil, a husband of three and a father of nine at the time, having relations with Nana, out of wedlock. Which was worse, Rashid's magazine, or what Jalil had done? And what entitled her, anyway, a villager, a harami, to pass judgment? Mariam tried the bottom drawer of the dresser. It was there that she found a picture of the boy, Yunus. It was a black and white. He looked four, maybe five. He was wearing a striped shirt and a bow tie. He was a handsome little boy, with a slender nose, brown hair, and dark, slightly sunken eyes. He looked distracted, as though something had caught his eye, just as the camera had flashed. Beneath that, Mariam found another photo, also black and white, this one slightly more grainy. It was of a seated woman, and behind her, a thinner, younger Rashid with black hair. The woman was beautiful. Not as beautiful as the women in the magazine, perhaps, but beautiful. Certainly more beautiful than her, Mariam. She had a delicate chin and long, black hair parted in the center, high cheekbones and a gentle forehead. Mariam pictured her own face, her thin lips, and long chin, and felt a flicker of jealousy. She looked at this photo for a long time. There was something vaguely unsettling about the way Rashid seemed to loom over the woman. His hands on her shoulders, his savoring, tight-lipped smile, and her unsmiling, sullen face. The way her body tilted forward subtly, as though she were trying to wriggle free of his hands. Mariam put everything back where she'd found it. Later, as she was doing laundry, she regretted that she'd sneaked around in his room. For what? What thing of substance had she learned about him? That he owned a gun? That he was a man with the needs of a man? And she shouldn't have stared at the photo of him and his wife for as long as she had. Her eyes had read meaning into what was random body posture, captured in a single moment of time. What Mariam felt now, as the loaded clotheslines bounced heavily before her, was sorrow for Rashid. He, too, had had a hard life, a life marked by loss and sad turns of fate. Her thoughts returned to his boy, Yunus, who had once built snowmen in this yard, whose feet had pounded these same stairs. The lake had snatched him from Rashid, swallowed him up, just as a whale had swallowed the boy's namesake prophet in the Quran. It pained Mariam, it pained her considerably, to picture Rashid, panic-stricken and helpless, pacing the banks of the lake, and pleading with it to spit his son back onto dry land. And she felt for the first time a kinship with her husband. She told herself that they would make good companions after all. On the bus ride home from the doctor, the strangest thing was happening to Mariam. Everywhere she looked, she saw bright colors. On the drab, gray concrete apartments, on the tin-roofed, open-fronted stores, in the muddy water flowing in the gutters. It was as though a rainbow had melted into her eyes. Rashid was drumming his gloved fingers and humming a song. Every time the bus bucked over a pothole and jerked forward, his hand shot protectively over her belly. "What about Zaimai?" he said. "It's a good Pashtun name." "What if it's a girl?" Mariam said. "I think it's a boy. Yes, a boy." A murmur was passing through the bus. Some passengers were pointing at something, and other passengers were leaning across seats to see. "Look," said Rashid, tapping a knuckle on the glass. He was smiling. "There, see?" On the streets, Mariam saw people stopping in their tracks. At traffic lights, faces emerged from the windows of cars, turned upward toward the falling softness. What was it about a season's first snowfall Mariam wondered, that was so entrancing? Was it the chance to see something as yet unsoiled, untrodden? To catch the fleeting grace of a new season, a lovely beginning, before it was trampled and corrupted? If it's a girl, Rashid said, and it isn't, but if it is a girl, then you can choose whatever name you want. Mariam awoke the next morning to the sound of sawing and hammering. She wrapped a shawl around her and went out into the snow-blown yard. The heavy snowfall of the previous night had stopped. Now only scattering of light, swirling flakes tickled her cheeks. The air was windless and smelled like burning coal. Kabul was eerily silent, quilted in white, tendrils of smoke snaking up here and there. She found Rashid in the tool shed, pounding nails into a plank of wood. When he saw her, he removed a nail from the corner of his mouth. It was going to be a surprise. He'll need a crib. You weren't supposed to see until it was done. Mariam wished he wouldn't do that, hitch his hopes to its being a boy. As happy as she was about this pregnancy, his expectation weighed on her. Yesterday, Rashid had gone out and come home with a suede winter coat for a boy, lined inside with soft sheepskin, the sleeves embroidered with fine red and yellow silk thread. Rashid lifted a long, narrow board. As he began to saw it in half, he said the stairs worried him. Something will have to be done about them later, when he's old enough to climb. The stove worried him too, he said. The knives and forks would have to be stowed somewhere out of reach. You can't be too careful. Boys are reckless creatures. Mariam pulled the shawl around her against the chill. The next morning, Rashid said he wanted to invite his friends for dinner to celebrate. All morning, Mariam cleaned lentils and moistened rice. She sliced eggplants for bourani and cooked leeks and ground beef for Arshak. She swept the floor, beat the curtains, aired the house, despite the snow that had started up again. She arranged mattresses and cushions along the walls of the living room, placed bowls of candy and roasted almonds on the table. She was in her room by early evening, before the first of the men arrived. She lay in bed as the hoots and laughter and bantering voices downstairs began to mushroom. She couldn't keep her hands from drifting to her belly. She thought of what was growing there, and happiness rushed in, like a gust of wind blowing a door wide open. Her eyes watered. Mariam thought of her 650-kilometer bus trip with Rashid from Herat in the west, near the border with Iran, to Kabul in the east. They had passed small towns and big towns and knots of little villages that kept springing up one after another. They had gone over mountains and across raw-burned deserts from one province to the next. And here she was now, over those boulders and parched hills, with a home of her own, a husband of her own, heading toward one final, cherished province, motherhood. How delectable it was to think of this baby, her baby, their baby. How glorious it was to know that her love for it already dwarfed anything she had ever felt as a human being, to know that there was no need any longer for pebble games. Downstairs, someone was tuning a harmonium. Then the clanging of a hammer, tuning a tabla. Someone cleared his throat. And then there was whistling and clapping and yipping and singing. Mariam stroked the softness of her belly. No bigger than a fingernail, the doctor had said. I'm going to be a mother, she thought. I'm going to be a mother, she said. Then she was laughing to herself and saying it over and over, relishing the words. When Mariam thought of this baby, her heart swelled inside of her. It swelled and swelled until all the loss, all the grief, all the loneliness and self-abasement of her life washed away. This was why God had brought her here, all the way across the country. She knew this now. She remembered a verse from the Quran that Mullah Faizullah had taught her. And Allah is in the east and the west. Therefore, wherever you turn, there's Allah's purpose. She laid down her prayer rug and did namaz. When she was done, she cupped her hands before her face and asked God not to let all this good fortune slip away from her. It was Rashid's idea to go to the hammam. Mariam had never been to a bathhouse, but he said there was nothing finer than stepping out and taking the first breath of cold air to feel the heat rising from the skin. In the women's hammam, shapes moved about in the steam around Mariam. A glimpse of a hip here, the contour of a shoulder there. The squeals of young girls, the grunts of old women, and the trickling of bathwater echoed between the walls as backs were scrubbed and hair soaped. Mariam sat in the far corner by herself, working on her heels with a pumice stone, insulated by a wall of steam from the passing shapes. Then there was blood, and she was screaming. The sound of feet now, slapping against the wet cobblestone, faces peering at her through the steam, tongues clucking. Later that night, in bed, Faribah told her husband that when she'd heard the cry and rushed over, she'd found Rashid's wife, shriveled into a corner, hugging her knees, a pool of blood at her feet. You could hear the poor girl's teeth rattling, Hakim. She was shivering so hard. When Mariam had seen her, Faribah said, she had asked in a high, supplicating voice, "It's normal, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't it normal?" Another bus ride with Rashid, snowing again, falling thick this time. It was piling in heaps on sidewalks, on roofs, gathering in patches on the bark of straggly trees. Mariam watched the merchants plowing snow from their storefronts. A group of boys was chasing a black dog. They waved sportively at the bus. Mariam looked over to Rashid. His eyes were closed. He wasn't humming. Mariam reclined her head and closed her eyes too. She wanted out of her cold socks, out of the damp wool sweater that was prickly against her skin. She wanted away from this bus. At the house, Rashid covered her with a quilt when she lay on the couch, but there was a stiff, perfunctory air about this gesture.
"What kind of answer is that?" he said again. "That's what a mullah is supposed to say. You pay a doctor his fee, you want a better answer than God's will."
Mariam curled up her knees beneath the quilt and said he ought to get some rest.
"God's will," he simmered.
He sat in his room smoking cigarettes all day. Mariam lay on the couch, hands tucked between her knees, watched the whirlpool of snow twisting and spinning outside the window. She remembered Nana saying once that each snowflake was a sigh heaved by an aggrieved woman somewhere in the world. That all the sighs drifted up the sky, gathered into clouds, then broke into tiny pieces that fell silently on the people below.
"As a reminder of how women like us suffer," she'd said, "how quietly we endure all that falls upon us."
The grief kept surprising Mariam. All it took to unleash it was her thinking of the unfinished crib in the tool shed or the suede coat in Rashid's closet. The baby came to life then, and she could hear it. Could hear its hungry grunts, its gurgles and jabbering. She felt it sniffing at her breasts. The grief washed over her, swept her up, tossed her upside down. Mariam was dumbfounded that she could miss in such a crippling manner a being she had never even seen. Then there were days when the dreariness didn't seem quite as unrelenting to Mariam. Days when the mere thought of resuming the old patterns of her life did not seem so exhausting, when it did not take enormous efforts of will to get out of bed, to do her prayers, to do the wash, to make meals for Rashid. Mariam dreaded going outside. She was envious suddenly of the neighborhood women and their wealth of children. Some had 7 or 8 and didn't understand how fortunate they were, how blessed that their children had flourished in their wombs, lived to squirm in their arms and take the milk from their breasts. Children that they had not bled away with soapy water and the bodily filth of strangers down some bathhouse drain. Mariam resented them when she overheard them complaining about misbehaving sons and lazy daughters. A voice inside her head tried to soothe her with well-intended but misguided consolation. "You'll have others, inshallah. You're young. Surely you'll have many other chances." But Mariam's grief wasn't aimless or unspecific. Mariam grieved for this baby, this particular child,
who had made her so happy for a while. Some days she believed that the baby had been an undeserved blessing, that she was being punished for what she had done to Nana. Wasn't it true that she might as well have slipped that noose around her mother's neck herself? Treacherous daughters did not deserve to be mothers, and this was just punishment. She had fitful dreams of Nana's djinn sneaking into her room at night, burrowing its claws into her womb and stealing her baby. In these dreams, Nana cackled with delight and vindication. Other days, Mariam was besieged with anger. It was Rashid's fault for his premature celebration, for his foolhardy faith that she was carrying a boy, naming the baby as he had, taking God's will for granted. His fault for making her go to the bathhouse. Something there, the steam, the dirty water, the soap, something there had caused this to happen. No, not Rashid. She was to blame. She became furious with herself for sleeping in the wrong position, for eating meals that were too spicy, for not eating enough fruit, for drinking too much tea. It was God's fault for taunting her as he had, for not granting her what he had granted so many other women, for dangling before her, tantalizingly, what he knew would give her the greatest happiness, then pulling it away. But it did no good, all this fault-laying, all these harangues of accusations bouncing in her head. It was kufr, sacrilege, to think these thoughts. Allah was not spiteful. He was not a petty god. Mullah Faizullah's words whispered in her head. Blessed is he in whose hand is the kingdom, and he who has power over all things, who created death and life that he may try you. Ransacked with guilt, Mariam would kneel and pray for forgiveness for these thoughts. Meanwhile, a change had come over Rashid ever since the day at the bathhouse. Most nights when he came home, he hardly talked anymore. He ate, smoked, went to bed, sometimes came back in the middle of the night for a brief and, of late, quite rough session of coupling. He was more apt to sulk these days, to fault her cooking, to complain about clutter around the yard or point out even minor uncleanliness in the house. Occasionally, he took her around town on Fridays like he used to, but on the sidewalks he walked quickly and always a few steps ahead of her, without speaking, unmindful of Mariam, who almost had to run to keep up with him. He wasn't so ready with a laugh on these outings anymore. He didn't buy her sweets or gifts, didn't stop and name places to her as he used to. Her questions seemed to irritate him. One night they were sitting in the living room listening to the radio. Winter was passing. The stiff winds that plastered snow onto the face and made the eyes water had calmed. Silvery fluffs of snow were melting off the branches of tall elms and would be replaced in a few weeks with stubby, pale green buds. Rashid was shaking his foot absently to the tabla beat of a Amoang song, his eyes crinkled against cigarette smoke. "Are you angry with me?" Mariam asked. Rashid said nothing. The song ended and the news came on. A woman's voice reported that President Daoud Khan had sent yet another group of Soviet consultants back to Moscow, to the expected displeasure of the Kremlin. "I worry that you're angry with me." Rashid sighed. "Are you?" His eyes shifted to her. "Why would I be angry?" "I don't know, but ever since the baby..." "Is that the kind of man you take me for, after everything I've done for you?" "No, of course not. Then stop pestering me." "I'm sorry, Bobakh Rashid. I'm sorry." He crushed out his cigarette and lit another. He turned up the volume on the radio. "I've been thinking, though," Mariam said, raising her voice so as to be heard over the music. Rashid sighed again, more irritably this time, turned down the volume once more. He rubbed his forehead wearily. "What now?" "I've been thinking that maybe we should have a proper burial. For the baby, I mean. Just us, a few prayers, nothing more." Mariam had been thinking about it for a while. She didn't want to forget this baby. It didn't seem right not to mark this loss in some way that was permanent.
"What for?"
It's idiotic.
It would make me feel better, I think.
Then you do it, he said sharply. I've already buried one son. I won't bury another. Now, if you don't mind, I'm trying to listen.
He turned up the volume again, leaned his head back, and closed his eyes.
One sunny morning that week, Mariam picked a spot in the yard and dug a hole. In the name of Allah, and with Allah, and in the name of the Messenger of Allah, upon whom be the blessings and peace of Allah, she said under her breath, as her shovel bit into the ground. She placed the suede coat that Rashid had bought for the baby in the hole and shoveled dirt over it. You make the night to pass into the day, and you make the day to pass into the night, and you bring forth the living from the dead, and you bring forth the dead from the living, and you give sustenance to whom you please without measure. She patted the dirt with the back of the shovel. She squatted by the mound, closed her eyes. Give sustenance, Allah. Give sustenance to me. 1978. On April 17, 1978, the year Mariam turned 19, a man named Mir Akbar Khaybar was found murdered. 2 days later, there was a large demonstration in Kabul. Everyone in the neighborhood was in the streets talking about it. Through the window, Mariam saw neighbors milling about, chatting excitedly, transistor radios pressed to their ears. She saw Fariba leaning against the wall of her house, talking with a woman who was new to Demazang. Fariba was smiling and her palms were pressed against the swell of her pregnant belly. The other woman, whose name escaped Mariam, looked older than Fariba, and her hair had an odd purple tint to it. She was holding a little boy's hand. Mariam knew the boy's name was Tariq because she had heard this woman on the street call after him by that name. Mariam and Rashid didn't join the neighbors. They listened in on the radio as some 10,000 people poured into the streets and marched up and down Kabul's government district. Rashid said that Mir Akbar Khaybar had been a prominent communist and that his supporters were blaming the murder on President Daoud Khan's government. He didn't look at her when he said this. These days, he never did anymore, and Mariam wasn't ever sure if she was being spoken to. What's a communist? She asked. Rashid snorted and raised both eyebrows. You don't know what a communist is? Such a simple thing. Everyone knows. It's common knowledge. You don't? Bah. I don't know why I'm surprised. Then he crossed his ankles on the table and mumbled that it was someone who believed in Karl Marxist. Who's Karl Marxist? Rashid sighed. On the radio, a woman's voice was saying that Taraki, the leader of the Khalq branch of the PDPA, the Afghan Communist Party, was in the streets giving rousing speeches to demonstrators. What I meant was, what do they want? Mariam asked. These communists, what is it that they believe? Rashid chortled and shook his head, but Mariam thought she saw uncertainty in the way he crossed his arms, the way his eyes shifted. You know nothing, do you? You're like a child. Your brain is empty. There's no information in it. I asked because... Chopko, shut up. Mariam did. It wasn't easy tolerating him talking this way to her, to bear his scorn, his ridicule, his insults, his walking past her like she was nothing but a house cat. But after 4 years of marriage, Mariam saw clearly how much a woman could tolerate when she was afraid. And Mariam was afraid. She lived in fear of his shifting moods, his volatile temperament, his insistence on steering even mundane exchanges down a confrontational path that, on occasion, he would resolve with punches, slaps, kicks, and sometimes try to make amends for with polluted apologies and sometimes not. In the 4 years since the day at the bathhouse, there had been 6 more cycles of hopes raised, then dashed. Each loss, each collapse, each trip to the doctor, more crushing for Mariam than the last. With each disappointment, Rashid had grown more remote and resentful. Now nothing she did pleased him. She cleaned the house, made sure he always had a supply of clean shirts, cooked him his favorite dishes. Once, disastrously, she even bought makeup and put it on for him. But when he came home, he took one look at her and winced with such distaste that she rushed to the bathroom and washed it all off. Tears of shame mixing with soapy water, rouge, and mascara. Now Mariam dreaded the sound of him coming home in the evening. The key rattling, the creak of the door. These were sounds that set her heart racing. From her bed, she listened to the click-clack of his heels, to the muffled shuffling of his feet after he'd shed his shoes. With her ears, she took inventory of his doings. Chair legs dragged across the floor, the plaintive squeak of the cane seat when he sat, the clinking of spoon against plate, the flutter of newspaper pages flipped, the slurping of water. And as her heart pounded, her mind wondered what excuse he would use that night to pounce on her. There was always something, some minor thing that would infuriate him, because no matter what she did to please him, no matter how thoroughly she submitted to his wants and demands, it wasn't enough. She could not give him his son back. In this most essential way, she had failed him. 7 times she had failed him. And now she was nothing but a burden to him. She could see it in the way he looked at her, when he looked at her. She was a burden to him. "What's going to happen?" she asked him now. Rashid shot her a sidelong glance. He made a sound between a sigh and a groan, dropped his legs from the table and turned off the radio. He took it upstairs to his room. He closed the door. On April 27, Mariam's question was answered with crackling sounds and intense, sudden roars. She ran barefoot down to the living room and found Rashid already by the window, in his undershirt, his hair disheveled, palms pressed to the glass. Mariam made her way to the window next to him. Overhead, she could see military planes zooming past, heading north and east. Their deafening shrieks hurt her ears. In the distance, loud booms resonated, and sudden plumes of smoke rose to the sky. "What's going on, Rashid?" she said. "What is all this?" "God knows," he muttered. He tried the radio and got only static. "What do we do?" "Impatiently," Rashid said, "we wait." Later in the day, Rashid was still trying the radio as Mariam made rice with spinach sauce in the kitchen. Mariam remembered a time when she had enjoyed, even looked forward to, cooking for Rashid. Now cooking was an exercise in heightened anxiety. The kormas were always too salty or too bland for his taste. The rice was judged either too greasy or too dry. The bread declared too doughy or too crispy. Rashid's fault-finding left her stricken in the kitchen with self-doubt. When she brought him his plate, the national anthem was playing on the radio. "I made sabzi," she said. "Put it down and be quiet." After the music faded, a man's voice came on the radio. He announced himself as Air Force Colonel Abdul Qader. He reported that early in the day, the rebel 4th Armored Division had seized the airport and key intersections in the city. Kabul Radio, the Ministries of Communication and the Interior, and the Foreign Ministry building had also been captured. "Kabul was in the hands of the people now," he said proudly. "Rebel MiGs had attacked the presidential palace. Tanks had broken into the premises, and a fierce battle was underway there. Daoud's loyalist forces were all but defeated," Abdul Qader said in a reassuring tone. Days later, when the communists began the summary executions of those connected with Daoud Khan's regime, when rumors began floating about Kabul, of eyes gouged and genitals electrocuted in the Polecharchi prison, Mariam would hear of the slaughter that had taken place at the presidential palace. Daoud Khan had been killed, but not before the communist rebels had killed some 20 members of his family, including women and grandchildren. There would be rumors that he had taken his own life, that he'd been gunned down in the heat of battle, rumors that he'd been saved for last, made to watch the massacre of his family, then shot. Rashid turned up the volume and leaned in closer. A revolutionary council of the armed forces has been established, and our Vatan will now be known as the Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, Abdul Qader said. The era of aristocracy, nepotism, and inequality is over, fellow Hamvatans. We have ended decades of tyranny. Power is now in the hands of the masses and freedom-loving people. A glorious new era in the history of our country is afoot. A new Afghanistan is born. We assure you that you have nothing to fear, fellow Afghans. The new regime will maintain the utmost respect for principles, both Islamic and democratic. This is a time of rejoicing and celebration. Rashid turned off the radio. So is this good or bad? Mariam asked. Bad for the rich, by the sound of it, Rashid said. Maybe not so bad for us. Mariam's thoughts drifted to Jalil. She wondered if the communists would go after him then. Would they jail him? Jail his sons? Take his businesses and properties from him? Is this warm? Rashid said, eyeing the rice. I just served it from the pot. He grunted and told her to hand him a plate. Down the street, as the night lit up in sudden flashes of red and yellow, an exhausted Fariba had propped herself up on her elbows. Her hair was matted with sweat, and droplets of moisture teetered on the edge of her upper lip. At her bedside, the elderly midwife, Wajma, watched as Fariba's husband and sons passed around the infant. They were marveling at the baby's light hair, at her pink cheeks and puckered rosebud lips, at the slits of jade-green eyes moving behind her puffy lids. They smiled at each other when they heard her voice for the first time, a cry that started like the mew of a cat and exploded into a healthy, full-throated yowl. Noor said her eyes were like gemstones. Ahmad, who was the most religious member of the family, sang the azan in his baby sister's ear and blew in her face three times. Laila it is then? Hakim asked, bouncing his daughter. Laila it is, Fariba said, smiling tiredly. Night beauty. It's perfect. Rashid made a ball of rice with his fingers. He put it in his mouth, chewed once, then twice, before grimacing and spitting it out on the sofra. What's the matter? Mariam asked, hating the apologetic tone of her voice. She could feel her pulse quickening, her skin shrinking. What's the matter? He mewled, mimicking her. What's the matter is that you've done it again. But I boiled it 5 minutes more than usual. That's a bold lie. I swear. He shook the rice angrily from his fingers and pushed the plate away, spilling sauce and rice on the sofra. Mariam watched as he stormed out of the living room, then out of the house, slamming the door on his way out. Mariam kneeled to the ground and tried to pick up the grains of rice and put them back on the plate. But her hands were shaking badly, and she had to wait for them to stop. Dread pressed down on her chest. She tried taking a few deep breaths. She caught her pale reflection in the darkened living room window and looked away. Then she heard the front door opening, and Rashid was back in the living room. Get up, he said. Come here, get up. He snatched her hand, opened it, and dropped a handful of pebbles into it. Put these in your mouth. What? Put these in your mouth. Stop it, Rashidam. His powerful hands clasped her jaw. He shoved two fingers into her mouth and pried it open, then forced the cold, hard pebbles into it. Mariam struggled against him, mumbling, but he kept pushing the pebbles in, his upper lip curled in a sneer. Now chew, he said. Through the mouthful of grit and pebbles, Mariam mumbled a plea. Tears were leaking out of the corners of her eyes. Chew! He bellowed. A gust of his smoky breath slammed against her face. Mariam chewed. Something in the back of her mouth cracked. Good, Rashid said. His cheeks were quivering. Now you know what your rice tastes like. Now you know what you've given me in this marriage. Bad food and nothing else. Then he was gone, leaving Mariam to spit out pebbles, blood, and the fragments of two broken molars. Part 2. Kabul, Spring 1987. 9-year-old Laila rose from bed, as she did most mornings, hungry for the sight of her friend Tariq. This morning, however, she knew there would be no Tariq sighting. "How long will you be gone?" she'd asked when Tariq had told her that his parents were taking him south to the city of Ghazni to visit his paternal uncle. 13 days. 13 days? It's not so long. You're making a face, Laila.
I'm not.
You're not going to cry, are you?
I am not going to cry. Not over you. Not in 1,000 years.
She'd kicked at his shin. Not his artificial, but his real one. And he'd playfully whacked the back of her head. 13 days. Almost 2 weeks. And, just 5 days in, Laila had learned a fundamental truth about time. Like the accordion on which Tariq's father sometimes played old Pashto songs, time stretched and contracted depending on Tariq's absence or presence. Downstairs, her parents were fighting, again. Laila knew the routine. Mami, ferocious, indomitable, pacing and ranting. Bobby, sitting, looking sheepish and dazed, nodding obediently, waiting for the storm to pass. Laila closed her door and changed. But she could still hear them. She could still hear her. Finally, a door slammed. Pounding footsteps. Mummy's bed creaked loudly. Bobby, it seemed, would survive to see another day.
Laila, he called now. I'm going to be late for work. 1 minute.
Laila put on her shoes and quickly brushed her shoulder-length, blonde curls in the mirror. Mummy always told Laila that she had inherited her hair color, as well as her thick-lashed turquoise green eyes, her dimpled cheeks, her high cheekbones, and the pout of her lower lip, which Mami shared, from her great-grandmother, Mami's grandmother. She was a pari, a stunner, Mami said. Her beauty was the talk of the valley. It skipped 2 generations of women in our family, but it sure didn't bypass you, Laila. The valley Mami referred to was the Panjshir, the Farsi-speaking Tajik region, 100 kilometers northeast of Kabul. Both Mami and Bobby, who were first cousins, had been born and raised in Panjshir. They had moved to Kabul back in 1960 as hopeful, bright-eyed newlyweds when Bobby had been admitted to Kabul University. Laila scrambled downstairs, hoping Mami wouldn't come out of her room for another round. She found Bobby kneeling by the screen door.
"Did you see this, Laila?"
The rip in the screen had been there for weeks. Laila hunkered down beside him.
No, must be new.
That's what I told Fariba. He looked shaken, reduced, as he always did after Mami was through with him. She says it's been letting in bees. Laila's heart went out to him. Bobby was a small man with narrow shoulders and slim, delicate hands, almost like a woman's. At night, when Laila walked into Bobby's room, she always found the downward profile of his face burrowing into a book, his glasses perched on the tip of his nose. Sometimes he didn't even notice that she was there. When he did, he marked his page, smiled a close-lipped, companionable smile. Bobby knew most of Rumi's and Hafiz's ghazals by heart. He could speak at length about the struggle between Britain and Tsarist Russia, over Afghanistan. He knew the difference between a stalactite and a stalagmite, and could tell you that the distance between the earth and the sun was the same as going from Kabul to Ghazni 1.5 million times. But if Laila needed the lid of a candy jar forced open, she had to go to Mami, which felt like a betrayal. Ordinary tools befuddled Bobby. On his watch, squeaky door hinges never got oiled. Ceilings went on leaking after he plugged them. Mold thrived defiantly in kitchen cabinets. Mami said that before he left with Noor to join the jihad against the Soviets back in 1980, it was Ahmad who had dutifully and competently minded these things. "But if you have a book that needs urgent reading," she said, "then Hakim is your man." Still, Laila could not shake the feeling that at one time, before Ahmad and Nur had gone to war against the Soviets, before Bobby had let them go to war, Mommy, too, had thought Bobby's bookishness endearing, that once upon a time, she, too, had found his forgetfulness and ineptitude charming. "So what is today?" he said now, smiling coyly. "Day 5, or is it 6? "What do I care? I don't keep count," Laila lied, shrugging, loving him for remembering. Mami had no idea that Tariq had left. "Well, his flashlight will be going off before you know it," Bobby said, referring to Laila and Tariq's nightly signaling game. They had played it for so long it had become a bedtime ritual, like brushing teeth. Bobby ran his finger through the rip. "I'll patch this as soon as I get a chance. We'd better go." He raised his voice and called over his shoulder. "We're going now, Fariba. I'm taking Laila to school. Don't forget to pick her up." Outside, as she was climbing on the carrier pack of Bobby's bicycle, Laila spotted a car parked up the street, across from the house where the shoemaker, Rashid, lived with his reclusive wife. It was a Benz, an unusual car in this neighborhood, blue with a thick white stripe bisecting the hood, the roof, and the trunk. Laila could make out two men sitting inside, one behind the wheel, the other in the back. "Who are they?" she said. "It's not our business," Bobby said. "Climb on, you'll be late for class." Laila remembered another fight, and that time, Mommy had stood over Bobby and said in a mincing way, "That's your business, isn't it, cousin? To make nothing your business, even your own son's going to war. How I pleaded with you. But you buried your nose in those cursed books and let our sons go like they were a pair of haramis." Bobby pedaled up the street, Laila in the back, her arms wrapped around his belly. As they passed the blue Benz, Laila caught a fleeting glimpse of the man in the back seat. Thin, white-haired, dressed in a dark brown suit, with a white handkerchief triangle in the breast pocket. The only other thing she had time to notice was that the car had Herat license plates. They rode the rest of the way in silence, except at the turns, where Bobby braked cautiously and said, "Hold on, Laila. Slowing down, there." In class that day, Laila found it hard to pay attention, between Tariq's absence and her parents' fight. So when the teacher called on her to name the capitals of Romania and Cuba, Laila was caught off guard. The teacher's name was Shanzai, but behind her back, the students called her Khala Rangmal, Auntie Painter, referring to the motion she favored when she slapped students. Palm, then back of the hand, back and forth like a painter working a brush. Khala Rangmal was a sharp-faced young woman with heavy eyebrows. On the first day of school, she had proudly told the class that she was the daughter of a poor peasant from Khost. She stood straight and wore her jet-black hair pulled tightly back and tied in a bun so that, when Khala Rangmal turned around, Laila could see the dark bristles on her neck. Khala Rangmal did not wear makeup or jewelry. She did not cover and forbade the female students from doing it. She said women and men were equal in every way, and there was no reason women should cover if men didn't. She said that the Soviet Union was the best nation in the world, along with Afghanistan. It was kind to its workers, and its people were all equal. Everyone in the Soviet Union was happy and friendly, unlike America, where crime made people afraid to leave their homes. And everyone in Afghanistan would be happy too, she said, once the anti-progressives, the backward bandits, were defeated. That's why our Soviet comrades came here in 1979, to lend their neighbor a hand, to help us defeat these brutes who want our country to be a backward, primitive nation. And you must lend your own hand, children. You must report anyone who might know about these rebels. It's your duty. You must listen, then report, even if it's your parents, your uncles, or aunts, because none of them love you as much as your country does. Your country comes first, remember. I will be proud of you, and so will your country. On the wall behind Khala Rangmal's desk was a map of the Soviet Union, a map of Afghanistan, and a framed photo of the latest communist president, Najibullah, who, Bobby said, had once been the head of the dreaded Khad, the Afghan secret police. There were other photos, too, mainly of young Soviet soldiers shaking hands with peasants, planting apple saplings, building homes, always smiling genially. "Well," Khola Rangmal said now, "have I disturbed your daydreaming, Inqilabi girl?" This was her nickname for Laila, Revolutionary Girl, because she'd been born the night of the April coup of 1978. Except Khola Rangmal became angry if anyone in her class used the word coup. What had happened, she insisted, was an inqilab, a revolution, an uprising of the working people against inequality. Jihad was another forbidden word. According to her, there wasn't even a war out there in the provinces, just skirmishes against troublemakers stirred by people she called foreign provocateurs. And certainly no one dared repeat in her presence the rising rumors that, after 8 years of fighting, the Soviets were losing this war. Particularly now that the American President Reagan had started shipping the Mujahideen Stinger missiles to down the Soviet helicopters, now that Muslims from all over the world were joining the cause. Egyptians, Pakistanis, even wealthy Saudis who left their millions behind and came to Afghanistan to fight the jihad. "Bucharest, Havana," Laila managed. "And are those countries our friends or not?" "They are, Maulim Sahib. They're friendly countries." Khola Rangmal gave a curt nod. When school let out, Mummy again didn't show up like she was supposed to. Laila ended up walking home with two of her classmates, Giti and Hasina. Giti was a tightly wound, bony little girl who wore her hair in twin ponytails held by elastic bands. She was always scowling and walking with her books pressed to her chest like a shield. Hasina was 12, 3 years older than Laila and Giti, but had failed third grade once and fourth grade twice. What she lacked in smarts, Hasina made up for in mischief and a mouth that, Giti said, ran like a sewing machine. It was Hasina who had come up with the Khola Rangmal nickname. Today, Hasina was dispensing advice on how to fend off unattractive suitors. "Foolproof method, guaranteed to work. I give you my word." "This is stupid. I'm too young to have a suitor," Giti said. "You're not too young." "Well, no one's come to ask for my hand." "That's because you have a beard, my dear." Giti's hand shot up to her chin, and she looked with alarm to Laila, who smiled pityingly, and shook her head with reassurance. Giti was the most humorless person Laila had ever met. "Anyway, you want to know what to do or not, ladies?"
"Go ahead," Laila said.
"Beans, no less than 4 cans, on the evening the toothless lizard comes to ask for your hand. But the timing, ladies, the timing is everything. You have to suppress the fireworks till it's time to serve him his tea."
"I'll remember that," Laila said.
"So will he." Laila could have said then that she didn't need this advice because Bobby had no intention of giving her away anytime soon. Though Bobby worked at Silo, Kabul's gigantic bread factory, where he labored amid the heat and the humming machinery, stoking the massive ovens and mill grains all day, he was a university-educated man. He'd been a high school teacher before the communists fired him. This was shortly after the coup of 1978, about a year and a half before the Soviets had invaded. Bobby had made it clear to Laila from a young age that the most important thing in his life, after her safety, was her schooling. "I know you're still young, but I want you to understand and learn this now," he said. "Marriage can wait. Education cannot. You're a very, very bright girl. Truly you are. You can be anything you want, Laila. I know this about you. And I also know that when this war is over, Afghanistan is going to need you as much as its men, maybe even more. Because a society has no chance of success if its women are uneducated, Laila. No chance." But Laila didn't tell Hasina that Bobby had said these things, or how glad she was to have a father like him, or how proud she was of his regard for her, or how determined she was to pursue her education.